From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia Maria Gross is away this week. On today's show, hear from some of the people who would be most affected by immigration reform.
It's a great chance for my parents not to have to go back if they ever get caught by the police for not turning a light or something.
With halls leaving the plaza and expanding in Crown Center, we look at the retail trends in the two shopping districts. Plus, visit a Wiccan summer solstice celebration in Independence.
The magic of the circle remains. The circle is open, but never broken.
And a local R&B group that hit it big in the 70s is still at it.
They said that we were better than Al Green and that we were better than Curtis Mayfield. That's what the critics said.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We take you to neighborhoods around the region using voices, stories, and sound.
The United States Senate is debating a bill that would give legal status to more than 11 million undocumented immigrants. And last week in Olathe, Kansas, about 100 people rallied outside of Senator Jerry Moran's office in support of the legislation. Many at the rally had come to the United States illegally, and a number of them had been approved for deferred action, which protects children of undocumented immigrants from deportation. Casey Currents intern Monica Sandretsky visited the rally. She spoke to several people, like Sylvia Lachoa, who hope the new immigration bill will grant them more permanent status.
My parents and I are from Ciudad Juarez. We came here when I was 11. And ever since then, well, we've been hearing that there's going to be an immigration reform, and it hasn't yet happened. Recently, there was the deferred action that gave us the opportunity to get a working permit and a Social Security. And that was a great thing. I mean, I was happy about that. I don't complain, but, I mean, if we can get these through, it's a great chance for my parents not to have to go back if they ever get, you know, caught by the police for not turning a light or something. I myself had to apply for the deferred action to be able to go back to school and give my daughter a better future for that matter. She's a little sick, but she's here. I want her to be here supporting for my parents and myself. Hope she sees that when she grows, that she understands how fortunate she is being from this country.
My name is Brandon Valdez, and I'm 12. Hopefully, we become citizens and we get more opportunities because our parents can't really get jobs because they're not from here. So it would really benefit us a lot, and it would give us also opportunities. You know, we might get to go to college or something like that.
I'm Ricardo Quinones. I'm one of the undocumented students and stuff like that, and so I guess I applied for deferred action and got it. And so, but that program is not set in stone. So we have a new president in 2016. It might affect me at all. And so, yeah, I have two brothers who are citizens. Both of my parents are legal permanent residents. And so the thing is, I aged out when my parents petitioned for me. Getting a lawyer and paying for the fees is more than $2,000. And so my parents started out as farmers when they first came here. They worked in the meat processor plant. And so they never had enough money to actually save up. When they did have enough money to save up, like in 2001, 2002, I got aged out. And so I guess they terminated my application because I turned 21.
My parents are originally immigrants. And it's been about 22 years since my dad last saw his mom. And I've never seen my grandma before. My name's Selena Urizar, and I'm 16 years old. So I'd really want to get to meet her, and she was just diagnosed with cancer last year, and so like the time is not on our side. So I'd really like to meet her if anything happened. And I mean, I've never seen anyone from Mexico, like any relatives, and I'd really like to meet them. And it's just like bring my family together. I just want my dad, because my dad didn't get to see his dad, and his dad passed away. And, I mean, it'd be really exciting for him to see his mom. It would mean everything to me, especially because I'm a daddy's girl. So I'd really want to see my dad happy.
Last Thursday, KCOR's Steve Kraske talked with Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach and author Alvaro Vargas Llosa about immigration legislation at the State House and in Congress. You can hear that interview by visiting our archives at kcor.org.
Midwest waterways are getting lots of attention this summer. Scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey and the Environmental Protection Agency have immersed themselves in the ecology of 100 streams from Ohio to Nebraska. It's a first-of-its-kind effort to understand how agricultural runoff is not just changing the water, but affecting the critters that live there. Harvest Public Media's Abby Fentress Swanson joined a crew on a rainy day while they gathered water samples and searched for fish eggs on three streams in central Missouri. Here's her report.
It's high noon, yet just north of Mexico, Missouri, the skies are dark above Skull Lick Creek. This storm, with its driving rain and bright bolts of lightning, would drive most people inside, but not environmental toxicologist Don Tillett. In his blue anorak, convertible pants, and hiking boots, he's ready for the elements. The creek's muddy waters have risen above its banks, though, so Tillett says there will be no looking for minnow eggs today.
So we won't go in there this morning. It's too high. Hopefully the fish will be fine for another day or two.
This rain is not making your work any easier.
No, not at all. It's keeping the water level up, so it's hard to maintain the chambers and the cages, but it's also keeping the water temperature down.
Tillett's part of a team of five scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey who are collecting water samples and checking cages for fish eggs on a number of Missouri streams this summer. They're testing for hundreds of pesticides and nutrients used in farming. Similar teams of chemists, hydrologists, and biologists are wading into other streams all across the Midwest, 100 streams in total. It's the first time scientists have tested for so many chemicals in a whole region's waters, or considered the impact of ag runoff on fish, frogs, bugs, and algae at this scale.
These aren't the kinds of studies that are done routinely because they are pretty difficult to do.
Diana Papoulias is one of the biologists charged with checking cages of minnows for eggs.
But we know that some of these chemicals that we're finding and the runoff from the ag fields can affect reproduction and egg production. Whether they're at the concentrations that can do that or not, we don't know yet. That's what the chemists are going to be helping us with.
On this day, the team has better luck at Goodwater Creek. Plenty of fish live in the stream's murky, slow-moving water, along with snakes, crayfish, mussels, and snapping turtles. In his bright orange life jacket and waders, chemist Dave Alvarez collects water by dipping a bottle attached to a long rod deep into the stream.
So with this bottle here, we're collecting a water sample, trying to catch any runoff that's coming down through for the pesticides. I just take this bottle, I dip it in the stream, I do it at equal distances across the creek. That way I kind of get a mixture, a good representative sample of what's flowing through here.
Probably impossible to say, but what do you think might be in there?
Well, considering the farmland around here and the history of this site, we'd expect potentially atrazine and some of the other pesticides if they have been applying.
Chances are they have. Atrazine is widely used to kill weeds in fields of corn, sorghum, and sugarcane. But when major storms hit, the chemical doesn't often stay on the fields. Atrazine was found in about 90% of the over 1,000 samples the U.S. Geological Survey collected from streams in agricultural areas nationwide. Legislation being considered in the U.S. House would ban the chemical, which environmental advocates argue has been linked to reproductive problems in fish, mammals, and even humans. With this comprehensive study of Midwestern streams, the scientists also want to find out the levels of mercury and livestock hormones in the water. The big unknown, though, is the weed killer glyphosate, known by the trade name Roundup, according to hydrologist Peter Van Meter.
Glyphosate's come in as the largest herbicide used now, where 20 years ago its use was pretty small.
Although the scientists didn't have good luck at all their sites today due to the wet weather, they'll be visiting each stream at least once a week until the end of July. Results will trickle in after the fieldwork's complete in August. Abby Fentress-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up, the department store Halls is relocating from the plaza. Hear how some shoppers react. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith, sitting in for Sylvia Maria Gross. Earlier this month, the high-end department store Halls, which is run by Hallmark, announced it was closing its location on the plaza and expanding in a new 60,000-foot location on the third floor of Crown Center. The department store is one of the big anchors on the plaza, and it's been there for more than 50 years. We sent Casey Current's intern Ryan Schisler to ask some shoppers on the plaza and at Crown Center what they thought and how the two shopping districts have changed over the years.
It's summertime on the plaza, and that means it's hot. Shoppers are loaded down with bags, hopping from store to store to keep out of the sun, and determined tourists are still out taking pictures of the fountains. The buzz in the air, though, is Halls.
My name is Mary Lou White. I had some shopping to do at Halls, in fact. I'm very sad, disappointed. It's a beautiful, beautiful store that's been here for a long, long time. I shop here frequently, always have, and it's going to be missed. What I hope they don't do is turn it into another teeny bopper store like Forever 21. That used to be a gorgeous Swanson store, and now it's that store.
My name is Saudi Bush, and I'm just shopping, but I live in Florida visiting, but originally from here. I think in a long run, I can see their point of not having two stores so close. I just hate to think that it's the plaza that's going.
Noreen Collada and I work down here at Lockton. I think for people who've lived around here a long time and shop there, I think they will miss it and feel like something is missing. But Hall's clientele is very select, and they'll go to Crown Center. They'll follow them there if that's where they shop. I mean, it'd be nice if another department-type store moved down here.
I'm Laura Brown. I came down here to use some banking services and have lunch. I haven't been in there, but it was so overpriced that I don't go there other than Christmas time to enjoy the poinsettia tree. I don't support it because of the prices, so if they had something in between, that would be awesome.
Besides the Hall store closing, some in the plaza have noticed the number of local stores in the district decreasing, drawing different opinions on where the plaza is going.
Hi, my name is Dr. Tiffany Lewis. I'm a veterinarian, currently reside in Florida, but I'm originally from Kansas City. There are a plethora of shops now and places to eat. Like a lot of the places that when I lived in Florida, I say, well, you guys don't have this and you don't have that. Like even like the Fogo de Chao and things of that nature. You guys have really, I think, built the area up. Honestly, I'm pretty commercialized. I mean, some of the things are kind of cool. Like I went into one of the little shops. I don't even think it was over here, but one of the little local shops and bought like some vintage jewelry, and that's kind of cool. I mean, it's sad for, you know, small business owners and things of that nature, but to be honest, I kind of like having that national variety, you know, so I don't know. Me, I'm kind of commercialized, so.
Meanwhile, in Crown Center, the heat isn't keeping families from visiting. Most of them are from out of town, visiting Kansas City, so they didn't know about Hall's move, if they even knew what Hall's was. To them, and to some locals, Crown Center is just a great place to bring their kids.
Brandis Milam, I'm from Washington, Kansas. Actually, we had an appointment with my daughter over at Children's Mercy, so we thought we'd bring our son over here to play, and it seems like a really good kid-friendly area. Actually, we just got here, and he's just in love with the fountains and the water and everything. He's a little water bug.
My name's Carla Dickey. I'm from Warsaw, Missouri. Our grandson brought him to Legoland and the aquarium. This is our first time for a long time. I don't think it's changed a whole lot, but except for the aquarium and the Legoland, I think a lot of families like to come down here.
My name is Megan Murphy. We're from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but we heard about it even there, so it's one of the things we wanted to do. We heard that, well, number one, that there was an aquarium, and Annabelle loves fish, so we decided to come. And her mom had researched it and found that there were so many things to do around here.
My name is Mario Mejia. I come in to see the Kansas City Aquarium. It's a really nice. I love the place. They have less traffic, less thing, and they have more things for kids to grow up in a good way. And I love Kansas City that way. We should keep it all time like that.
My name is Louise Wade. I've lived here since 1985. It's always seemed kid-friendly to me. At first, you know, Kaleidoscope's always been here, and there's always been something going on for the children. Used to have the pumpkin patch going on, and when one thing went away, seems like it was replaced with something else, so I really can't say that, you know, I've seen a big difference. It's always been kid-friendly as far as I'm concerned.
Those were some patrons of Crown Center and the Plaza recorded by Ryan Schisler. To find out more about the hall's move and trends in retail at the two shopping malls, I sat down with Autumn Morningstar, who is reporting on retail for the Kansas City Business Journal.
For Halls itself, it was kind of a good business move because with the incoming tenants, with the new Sea Life Aquarium and with the Legoland Discovery Center moving into Halls, it kind of sparsed all of their retail locations out among the entire Crown shops. So with that being there and then having, you know, another location 20 blocks away at the Country Club Plaza, it was kind of a good consolidation effort. It's the home of their parent company, Hallmark. And then Kelly Cole, the CEO of Halls, was talking about how he kind of sees a trend in retail shifting towards a more casual lifestyle. And so that's one of the things that Halls is trying to grasp.
So there was a difference between the items that Halls on the Plaza had and the one in Crown Center.
I would say so. I would say they're leaning towards definitely a more casual trend in the new location. With the presence of e-commerce retailers becoming more and more prevalent, they have a lot to compete with. Their lease at the Country Club Plaza was not up until 2016, so it's really interesting that they decided to vacate a couple years early. With the plaza being such a high-end location for retailers, it's going to be pretty easy, they think, to get a new tenant booked in there, whether they'll sparse that location up to several new tenants or whether they'll keep the entire department store as a whole will be something that's remained to be seen, but it'll be interesting.
Well, that begs the question, why right now for this move?
One thing that Halls executives are really excited about is the resurgence of downtown, and Crown Center is playing a pretty big part of that, you know, with Sea Life Aquarium and Legoland Discovery Center. So not only that, but there's a lot of renovations to the two hotels there, the Sheraton and Westin, Kansas City and Crown Center. So they see that as a big opportunity, not to just garner the downtown Kansas City residents, but also attract the tourist clientele. They see that as a very big opportunity.
And they're thinking probably the tourist clientele won't necessarily be interested in ball gowns or high-end jewelry, I guess.
Probably not. It was interesting. I talked to a senior retail advisor at Colliers International, and he was saying he had attempted in the past to bring a Bloomingdale's to the Country Club Plaza. And he was talking to a Bloomingdale's representative, and they were saying they would need a clientele that goes to 5 black tie events per week. That's just not something the Kansas City clientele is looking for, not something that we do. So whether we can sustain this high-end retail market will be something we'll have to wait and see.
You mentioned that the plaza probably has other people who want to be in that location. Have you heard if there are any potential takers?
I've talked to Highwoods Properties vice president this morning, and they said they have a number of restaurants and retailers that are lined up and ready to take it, but at this point it's too far in advance to kind of let the public know who it's going to be.
You know, there's been a lot of discussion about the plaza changing and away again from the upscale stores and more toward national chains that you can find anywhere, and so you don't have as many specialty shops or one-of-a-kind shops anymore. And I guess the Halls leaving will be another trend in that direction. How do you think that will attract who goes to the plaza and its reputation in general?
Local high-end merchants are having a really hard time this day and age keeping up with larger national chains, and especially those that have an online presence. It's hard to compete with, for example, the lease that Halls had at the Country Club Plaza was, who knows what the terms were of renewing that lease. I mean, they've had it there for 50 years now. So them having to compete with online retailers and those national chains that have a big online presence is something that they are probably looking at in moving away. So you'll see a lot of big names, a lot of big chains moving into the plaza, a lot of higher end type of tenants.
Well, I thought they were going away on the plaza from higher end. Are you saying that they're going to do a mix, or they're going to focus on both the national chains and some higher end? Or
I would say it's a move away from local retailers, local higher end. And now they still want to attract that higher end clientele, but they're having a hard time doing it from a local perspective. So, yeah, less specialty shops.
Now let's talk about the potential impact on workers who were at the Hall store on the plaza. Have you heard what will happen with them?
So between the Country Club Plaza location and the Crown Center location that Halls have, there are about 230 full-time and part-time employees. Once they make the shift down to Crown Center in summer of 2014, they'll cut that by about half. So they've got employees from the plaza reapplying to positions to be able to still work in Crown Center, but it will be cut down by about half.
Also, when we're talking about Crown Center, there's also impact on some of the businesses there on the third floor who will either have to move or leave. What's the story there?
A lot of them have expiring leases, and from what I can gather, it seems like it's been a move that's been in the works for a while. So whether they'll vacate or decide to just relocate within Crown Center still remains to be seen. One thing that will be interesting to see is that there's a couple locations open surrounding Halls that it'll be interesting to see what kind of complementary retail destinations will be there. There's a couple restaurant locations that face the fountain, so it'll be interesting to see who they can attract to bring in there. They're also going to be doing a little bit of shifting of the parking to accommodate those who want to go straight to Halls. So they're still working on the plans for that, but that will be something really beneficial for their new shoppers.
Well, you know, that does make you wonder, because they're locating the full store there, it sounds like they might be rethinking other complementary tenants then?
Absolutely, definitely. As of right now, they don't have any plans for the east side of the Crown Center shops, where their department stores, where some of part of their department store is. So what will happen there, we don't know yet.
Now, Halls really hired some big guns to design this new store. What do you know about that?
So Halls will be employing Charles Sparks and Company to do the design, and they've done some exciting projects before. A lot of museums. They did the Nelson Atkins here in town. They also worked on the Art Institute of Chicago, the De Young Museum in San Francisco, and the Getty Center in L.A. So they're very excited about that.
In terms of the research you've done, what else can you say about this whole shift?
The executives at Halls really just want to be a part of the resurgence of downtown. And so they're hoping that moving into a place where their parent company already is will allow them to do that and allow them the freedom of not having to be in a lease. They're also looking to bank on about $50 million worth of private investment that have been made over the past decade or so. So those will all play really large into their relocation. And also the Legoland Discovery Center and the Sea Life Aquarium at Crown Center. Their sales down there, I hear, are booming. So they're eager to be a part of that.
So, yeah, capitalizing on the people who are coming to see those attractions, in other words.
Definitely, definitely.
Well, I really thank you for being on KC Currents.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That was Autumn Morningstar, a web producer for Kansas City Business Journal.
The summer solstice came and went on Friday. For most people, it's just a day to get out and enjoy the sun, but some observe it as a holy day. You may have noticed groups of people worshiping in area parks over the past few weeks, something they've been afraid to do in the past. But things have gotten better in recent years, they say, and now Wiccans are finding it easier to express their faith. KC Currents' Ryan Schisler caught up with a group in Independence who last weekend joined the Wiccan community around the world in observing the solstice.
So today we're going to celebrate the summer solstice, and yeah. Doesn't mean it's going to cool off yet, though. And the sun god did decide to bless us with his presence instead of...
The voice you're hearing belongs to a woman who goes by the name Jay. She's the leader of a coven, a sort of Wiccan church, called the Ithi Lushede. She's standing in the middle of a circle of about 30 people who have turned out for worship. They're in a park just off I-70 in Independence, and there's a true sign of modernity. You can see the massive Bass Pro Shop just over the trees. She and a few others begin to walk around the circle, beginning the ritual.
The Lord of Summer. May his fiery breath surround and protect us.
Wicca is a modern religion of witchcraft and nature worship, which falls under the umbrella term pagan, generally meaning one whose beliefs differ from Abrahamic monotheism, or in simpler terms, it's not Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. Instead of one god, they worship many. In some circles, the word pagan has some nasty connotations, but in this group, it's an identity, one they've become more open about in recent years. Jay says the turnout is pretty good today, and others in the circle are participating as well.
I call you, element of water, that which supports the silver wheel of Arianrod, the ever-turning wheel of the year that carries the souls of the dead back to PRCE, where they may rest until the next incarnation. Blessed be.
Blessed be.
There are even some theatrics. One man is dressed as the Oak King, who represents summer. He's wearing a leaf-printed cape and has a crown made of oak leaves on his head. The other is the Holly King, representing winter. The Holly King is dressed in a green robe with fluffy white trim, almost looking like Santa Claus. He's holding a staff he found in the woods nearby. The two have a battle, symbolizing the changing of the seasons, and even though it's a holy day, they ham it up a little for the rest of the group. There's also music and the sharing of small cakes and hibiscus tea, where worshippers wish each other, may you never hunger and may you never thirst. After about 20 minutes, the ceremony comes to a close.
As it ever flows, the magic of the circle remains. The circle is open, but never broken.
Other people in the park that day look on at the ritual, a few with confused faces. Some stop nearby to listen or to peer into the circle. After the ritual, Jay and a few others come together to talk, and the onlookers' presence did not go unnoticed.
This is a pretty public park for us, though.
Yeah, yeah, there's a really lot public. Of people milling around. Yeah. It's like yeah,
last time there was more. It was crazy. There was like 80 or 90 people around the circle last time from all the people in the park just like walking. What are you doing over there?
They're nervous because they say most Wiccans have a story of being harassed or even attacked, which is why they're cautious about using their full names. There's a man in the group named Christopher. He served 4 tours in the U.S. Army and was also once a Wiccan high priest in southern Georgia. He recalls an experience he had there in the 80s.
We actually had a guy come and kick one of our candles across and splash hot wax on a 2-year-old boy.
Those were dark days for the pagan community. The coven's high priest, who goes by the name Thorgo, calls those years the Satanic Panic. He says the conservative revolution of the 1980s turned against Wiccans and pagans, accusing them of being Satanists. Wiccan bookstores were closed down, incidents like the one Christopher witnessed started happening, and the entire community was pressured underground. Thorgo says things have gotten better, but even locally, there's still discrimination.
There's still a large number of people that are persecuted for their religion. And even here locally, you hear about, you know, there's still people currently in now in the 2013 that are being fired because it's found out that they're pagan or Wiccan.
Losing custody of their children.
It's a big problem in divorces. And certainly a lot of the problems is
because of the fear of being ostracized. Many Wiccans are still not open in their beliefs, making it difficult to measure just how many there are. Estimates of the number of Wiccans in the United States range from 700,000 to 3 million. After the ritual, the group celebrates the solstice with a barbecue and picnic. They're also holding a raffle to raise money for Pagan Pride Day, which is held in September. No curious bystanders approach them, but Jay says the coven welcomes any and all questions. Contrary to stereotypes, she says, there's no bloodletting and no animal sacrifice, both of which are against true Wiccan doctrine.
This is a family-friendly gathering that we have, and we're not doing anything illegal or immoral. We just see deity a little different, celebrate different holidays, or basically the same holidays with different names. And, you know, and we all have jobs, we all have families, we're just normal people. And we welcome if someone has questions and wants to ask them. It's not a problem.
Jay says there are about 90 people affiliated with her coven. Teachers, doctors, and veterans, young people, families, and seniors. They're part of a growing community, now reaching out to a society they say has long misunderstood them. For Casey Currents, I'm Ryan Schisler from Independence.
To see photos of Lucchetti Grove's observance of the summer solstice, visit the Casey Currents page at kcur.org. Jay and Thorgo were also in our studio last week as part of a discussion on Wicca on Central Standard. You can hear that show on our website, kcur.org.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
After the break, we head out to Kansas for the Symphony in the Flint Hills. This year, it was at Fort Riley. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
After 7 years of calling the Kansas Prairie home, the music of the Kansas City Symphony echoed from a different venue this summer. Fort Riley hosted the Symphony in the Flint Hills last Sunday, and KCUR intern Sangeeta Shastri headed out to northeastern Kansas to take a look.
Last Sunday, Fort Riley hosted the Symphony in the Flint Hills, an annual performance that brings one of the city's premier arts organizations to the middle of Kansas. Nestled next to Junction City in the northeastern part of the state, the fort's grounds were flooded by hundreds of picnic blankets and lawn chairs. Visitors also got a taste of Fort Riley's 160-year history, including a cavalry demonstration. Fort Riley is an army base that Major General George Custer, the famous Civil War figure, once called home. Military families roam the parade grounds with visitors from out of town, taking in the tradition.
What kind of horses are they?
All the ones here are quarter horses.
That's Sasha Deeds. She's a private first class from Texas. Alongside her quarter horse, Chico, Deeds rode in formation with the commanding general's mounted color guard to a cheering crowd.
We're out here just doing a demo, showing how the horsemen back in the days trained and basically bonded with their horses, showing how they used to do it with the sabers and with the pistol.
It takes horsemanship to do it. We got the best on the field right now.
All right, here's what we're going to do now.
For some, the Symphony in the Flint Hills is a family affair. Mary Schwab looked on as her 10-year-old granddaughter, Abby Rozier, tried her hand at the clarinet with P.J. Stevenson of Flint Hills Music.
You know what? Uncle Andy plays clarinet. You should hear.
He gave me it, but it doesn't work.
What?
So you gotta get that sucker fixed quick.
Flint Hills Music has set up what they're calling an instrument petting zoo.
Shannon, listen to this.
Mary's daughter, Shannon Rozier, was stationed at Fort Riley with her husband from 2003 to 2007. Now, they call Junction City home.
I'm so glad that they chose Fort Riley for this year because it's a different venue. It's never been in any kind of an urban, you know, populated venue. But Fort Riley has such an important history to the Flint Hills. I'm the assistant director of a small performing arts center in Junction City, and we've thought of trying to replicate this idea of an instrument petting zoo for one of the shows that we're doing this year.
Red-shirted volunteers roam the fields, offering up directions and pointing to much-needed water tanks as the sun begins to peek out from behind an overcast sky. Letty Carlson is one of those volunteers.
First time here, and my brother's been doing it for 8 years. It's wonderful, wonderful. Last year we were out on the Flint Hills. This year, you know, we're here in the fort. It's history. That's good. You know, get people to see it. And gosh, you know, 1880s till now, it's wonderful. I mean, I'd like to go to Kansas City and get them all to come to Kansas City too, but you know, some of them can't make it to Kansas City for all the symphonies, and they can make it here.
Down a trail that leads to a wide, leafy boulevard of officers' homes, people relax on wraparound porches. A giant yellow welcome home ribbon adorns the front of Lieutenant Colonel Charles Stamm's house. Men and women in Civil War era costumes shepherd lines of visitors along the sidewalks.
With the 1st Infantry Division, in one way or another, they either serve.
That's Brenda Warner. She's one of the costumed volunteers standing in front of the more than 100-year-old home of Major General Funk, the commanding general of Fort Riley. Warner is the president of the Historical and Archaeological Society of Fort Riley, and she spent 21 years serving as a helicopter pilot.
I'm a retiree, so I've been all over the world, and I think some of the people in this area are some of the nicest in any place I've ever been. The beauty of the art and the music, and then to be able to incorporate the history of Fort Riley in this area here, I think is just, it's like taking two great things and combining them, you know, it's like cake and ice cream or cookies and milk.
Soon, the orchestra begins to tune up inside the curved white band shell. A few raindrops fall from the sky as Aram Demergen, assistant conductor of the Kansas City Symphony, leads the musicians through a sound check.
The performance is the culmination of everything else that has happened, the educational events, the reenactments, the activities. There are unique challenges that come with taking an orchestra and moving it 2 hours out of town, but the reward and the payoff, I mean, you just have to look at the 7,000 people that are sitting out there, and these are 7,000 people who are here for music. There's no amount of extra work that isn't worth that.
The clouds clear, and the concert begins.
We're very lucky in Kansas City and in our country to be able to have incredible events with these huge gatherings of people, and we owe it all to the work and sacrifice of our troops overseas protecting us, many of whom have trained here at Fort Riley, and a unit of whom I just learned before coming on stage returned home yesterday. So can we please give our troops a round of applause? Thank you.
The service that an orchestra performs for a community is changing. We are really called upon as artists to bring the art, to bring our music out into the community.
Not everyone can make the 2-hour trek to Helsburg Hall, Demergen says.
But everybody deserves to have music in their life and deserves to hear a great symphony orchestra. It can be a life-changing experience.
Soul music with tight vocal harmony and soaring falsetto was at the peak of popularity during the 70s and early 80s. This was also the case for the group Bloodstone, a Kansas City-born and bred R&B group. After being discovered by an English producer, Bloodstone performed with Marvin Gaye, Curtis Mayfield, and Elton John, among others. Serving up a rich mix of gospel, doo-wop, and funk, Bloodstone went on to produce a number of R&B hits, including a gold record for the 1973 single, Natural High. I recently caught up with an original group member, Charles Love, now Reverend Charles Love, to talk about the group. He says that before moving to L.A. and changing their name, Bloodstone was a singing group of classmates at Central High in the early 60s. They performed at talent shows and called themselves the Sincere's.
We were doing a show. There we were called the Sincere's, and they said, boys and girls, the Sincere's, right? And the act that was on before us The guy had a pocket comb in his pocket, and it slipped out on the floor. And it was a hardwood floor, and it was on the floor. So when they introduced us to come out, Harry, the lead singer, steps on this comb. His feet goes up in the air, and he falls flat, and he tries to adjust himself, and he turns and falls flat on his head. And this great big knot, this great big hickey, is growing, actually, and the show is going on, right? We have to, you know, we played it off like it was a Fourth of the Act. This great big knot is growing on his forehead right in front of me as I'm standing there. We're singing in the microphone, you know, woo. And I'm looking at him, and this knot is expanding on his head. It's growing on his head. We laughed about it afterwards when we got backstage. It was so funny.
So what was your first big break? Because I know you had a number of songs out, and then, of course, when Natural High hit, that was a big highlight. But what was your first big break?
It was in London. We were on the show with Al Green, and our Curtis Mayfield was one of those shows. It was, we did 1 week with Al Green and the other week with Curtis Mayfield. And the record companies of Europe, Polydor, Decca Records, and some others, that were big record companies in Europe, came to see Al Green and Curtis Mayfield those two nights, and we were on spot on. And they said, now that's what they said, that's not what I'm saying, they said that we were better than Al Green and that we were better than Curtis Mayfield. That's what the critics said.
That's a tall order.
They said that the upstarts, these upstarts, this unknown group called Bloodstone, stole the night, stole the evening. And from that, we got our first contract with Decca Records. So that was our first big break.
So was that when Natural High, the album, came about? Came later?
Natural High came later. We had an album and a CD before then. Well, an album before then, and it was just simply called Bloodstone. And Natural High was the second album, actually. And I take to the sky on a natural high, loving you more till the day I die. Take to the sky on a natural high, loving you more.
Now, were you surprised at the popularity when Natural High hit that... it got such a response?
Yes. As a matter of fact, none of us really believed in the song. Maybe Charles did. The writer, Charles McCormick, he might have believed in it. Well, he wrote it. I guess he did. We were going, it's too this, and it's too mushy this, and it's too that. And we found all kind of things to say. Shortly after the recording, we take off for Europe. When we get back from Europe, the song is on the radio, and it's going crazy on the charts, right? So I can truly say that that was a feeling and something that you, when you hear yourself on the radio for the first time, you know, and people saying positive things about it. I mean, while we were jumping around celebrating, I mean, you know, oh, wow. You know, listen, we're on the radio, man. Look, that's us. I think we were down south somewhere, too, when we first heard it on the radio.
And you didn't even think it was going to be a hit.
Right. And we had just got back from Europe.
Now, you know, you had a song, Outside Woman. And that was about the third woman out in her love triangle.
Sometimes it seems a million years between our little get-togethers. Oh, yeah. But I know, that I know, that you think.
What inspired that song? Who wrote that song?
Well, Harry Williams and myself, we wrote The Outside Woman. It was inspired not by something we were going through, but by something that we had, I initiated this song. Harry filled in. And, of course, he sang it. It was something that I had ran into a number of times while in my travels, and I've experienced it as well. But I mean, but basically, and there were a lot of women who were the outside woman. A lot of married men had outside interests, shall we say, you know? And these women were lonely. They were heartbroken and they were vexed. And they had a lot of problems, and my sentiment, my heart just went out to them. So I wrote this song. Harry and I wrote this song, "'Cause You're the Outside Woman, Don't Feel Bad. I lay next to another woman, but I call your name." You know, right, yeah, okay.
But yeah, that song received quite a bit of attention.
It certainly did, as a matter of fact. I got a lot of problems, a lot of trouble about that, especially from the church.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, because it is an adulterous affair, isn't it? The outside woman, it suggests a woman outside of a marriage, outside of something that is sanctioned by God, and then here comes this outside woman, this adulterous affair, vixen.
So you've always been involved in the church pretty heavily.
Well, we all have. We all came from church people. Charles McCormick, and more so than the rest of us, I believe, because his father was a minister. And as you can see now, I'm involved in the ministry. But anyway, it wasn't the focal point of our actions, but we always had a spiritual grounding there. There was just, we were wild and crazy, but there were just some things that we just wouldn't get involved with.
Now then you have the song, "We Go a Long Way Back."
And I'm so proud, yeah. You and me. Girl.
Again, I had the pleasure of writing that song. I was living in, I tell this story. I'm going to whisper this, right? But it's going to be on the radio, you know. I was living in Los Angeles, as a matter of fact. We had just signed with Motown. And got a nice little check from Motown, and I was moved to Lower Beverly Hills. Tipping and tall cotton, as they say. Oh, I thought I was hot stuff, right? Well, anyway, things didn't work out so well with Motown and Barry Gordy. So now I've got this expensive place, and I'm about to get evicted. So I'm with this lady. We'd been together for a long time. We went through things. And I wrote this song, "We Go a Long Way Back." You and me, girl, we go a long way back, and I'm so proud and so pleased with you. And you stuck on in there with me, and I stuck on in there with you, and you see what we made it through it all, and yada, yada, yada. But that's what inspired the song, a young lady that I was with.
And turned out to be a hit.
Turned out to be a hit. How about that? Well, what the Isley Brothers heard it. What happened was, the Isley Brothers heard this song, and they thought that they heard a tape, a little demo, the demo tape that I had, and they thought it was worth going in the studio and making a major production out of it. And that's what we did, and it did turn out to be a hit.
Now that's Harry's falsetto.
That's Harry's, and well, Charles McCormick is the falsetto singer. He sings false as well. But Harry sings the real, real high false, the one that that gets a lot of attention, and especially that loud, bodacious scream.
At the end of the song, toward the end of the song.
Yes, that's Harry. That's Harry. Long, 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 long.
That's a jam.
That's a jam. Yeah, that's it. That's the jam, and that's him. That's Eric.
Well, Reverend Charles Love, thank you so much for being on Casey Currents with me today.
Well, you're welcome. You're certainly welcome, Susan. Thank you so much for having me over.
Bloodstone slowed down a bit in the mid-80s, but they've never stopped performing. They'll perform next in Kansas City on June 28th at Crown Center. A new CD entitled Fly Away will be released this summer.
We close this week's show with another Bloodstone hit from 1973. This is Never Let You Go.
Been blown to bits. I was just about to call it quits. An everyday problem. I didn't stand a prayer. And you came along. And hope was there. There had been times when I thought that I could tune right up and break down. Your hand, you made me stand. You said, be a man. Yes, I know you can. And each and every day.
We thank you for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at KCUR.org.
Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at Casey Currents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Monica Sandretsky and Ryan Schisler. Theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.